everyone, and welcome back to a new year of Upzoned. This is the podcast where we take just one big story from the last week, or in this case, the last month in the Strunk Downs conversation, since we took a little break from the holidays, and we upzone it. We talk about it in depth between myself, Kia, and usually our president, Chuck Marone. And Chuck is here today. How are you doing, Chuck? Happy New Year.
Hey, Happy New Year. I'm doing fantastic. We have a nice bit of snow here now, finally. We had a brown Christmas, but it got about 18 inches shortly after, so it's gorgeous here. And yeah, I'm heading out of town in a few minutes, so no complaints.
Yeah. Well, when you say you're heading out of town, I know the destination is a little exciting. You're going to Disneyland with our board, because that's what we do at Strunk Downs. We do our meetings in theme parks, so we can not hate the entire experience like many people do at corporate retreats. I'm really excited for you.
Yeah, one of the many benefits of everyone working remotely is that we don't spend any money on office space. But we do have pretty cool meetings. So yeah, it's going to be fun. And you know, everybody here is not sick of winter yet, so I don't get like the jealousy from everybody for going to Southern California. But I know what's going to happen. It's going to be fun.
That'll be fun. Well, I want to dive into our topic this week because a story dropped just before the holiday break that I found really fascinating in the context of the Stronger conversation, the Strunk Towns conversation, excuse me. It is about dollar stores. And our friends at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance produced a little report on their effect on communities. We happen to have a little podcast coming up here shortly with Stacey Mitchell. It's actually an interactive webcast exclusively for members of the Strunk Towns movement. Stacey is the director, I believe, of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. So if you like what you hear on this conversation, you should consider becoming a Strunk Towns member so that you can ask Stacey some more questions about this. But I wanted to ask you, Chuck, how you felt about this report. Basically, to sum it up in broad strokes, and you can always look at the article yourself in the text of the podcast description, dollar stores are a pretty controversial thing in American cities these days. And in fact, ILSR is alleging that they are perpetuating inequality in communities in a way that might surprise some folks. They are not big box stores, but they are saying that the extractive nature of the dollar store is contributing to many of the same phenomena we see around the country when a big box store moves in, but they can do it at a smaller scale in cities that have been active about zoning for more density, zoning for a finer grain streetscape, what have you. I would love to hear what you think about the dollar store phenomenon and about ILSR's take on it.
Well, welcome to 2019. I mean, this is the story of America today, in a sense. I can see this, you know, out my window, actually. Brainerd, my hometown, it has how many dollars? Like four of them. And, you know, they're not out in the more affluent areas. They are in the poor areas of town. And there's a reason for that. I mean, what we have done in a macro sense, and then let's talk about the neighborhoods next, but in a macro sense, what we have done is we've created this growth economy, this debt economy. And one of its principal features is the extractive nature of it. I would put it this way. And I've written this a number of times, but it probably deserves a deeper conversation. We have come to the point in our country, in our conversation, where we think if we have a strong national economy, that will be good for cities and neighborhoods and places. If we can hit our GDP growth targets, if we can hit our national unemployment and inflation targets, that everybody will be doing better because a rising tide lifts all boats. And this is essentially trickle-down theory, and you can subscribe to it from a free market corporate standpoint, or you can subscribe to it from a government standpoint. It renders itself the same. This is the opposite of what not only a Strunk Towns approach is, but what historically cities have been, which is the way you have a strong country is by having strong cities, by having strong neighborhoods, by having places that are healthy and productive. And so what you get out of the economy we've created today is essentially growth is good. How do we create as much economic transaction as we can? If we were to look at the poor neighborhoods in my city, they need food. They need people providing services to them. And the thing is there's actual money and capital there, but not in the kind of hyper efficient way that we do it today. It's there, but it's there in a different way. It'd be like a slower burn kind of way. The neighborhood on the south side of town, which has $1 store and nothing else, no grocery stores. The last family grocery store closed last year, 2 years ago. That neighborhood used to have 13 grocery stores.
Wow.
Now, they were like these small, funky little grocery stores, right? Like, you know, one was like a butcher shop with a few other things. One was like a bodega kind of thing. I'm not talking about grocery stores like, you know, the massive big box one. But people in that neighborhood could get food from a wide variety of places. In the name of efficiency, we've wiped that out. And now what you're left with in places like this are just the big hyper-efficient conglomerates that can figure out the niche model to extract what little wealth there is left in these really, really poor neighborhoods and these very small towns. You know, we built from this, the sad thing is from this exact neighborhood, the one that's struggling the most in my community, we spent $9 million and $7.5 million of that was stimulus in the 2009, you know, Obama era stimulus package. We spent $9 million to run a shortcut, basically, a 2-lane little road we made into a 4-lane highway from this neighborhood to the Walmart in the neighboring city. And, you know, there's no way that a local entrepreneur, someone who wants to have a bodega or someone who wants to have a little corner market, there's no way they can make it. They're not viable. So you're left with this. And I think it's, you know, I look out my window and I'm like, this is a tragedy unfolding. And we have welcomed it with open arms.
So why is that tragedy unfolding? This is where I want to dig into the report a little bit. You know, a dollar store takes up about the same footprint or smaller as a community grocery often. And at Strongtowns, we talk a lot about land value, economics, value per acre. And I think maybe at a glance, if you didn't know the effect that dollar stores have on communities, it might seem like it's a kinder and gentler alternative to the big box because they don't always have the giant parking lot. You don't always need to raise a whole area in order to put one up. Why are they proliferating as they are? And why are they proliferating where they are? Let's talk about the specifics.
I think that you should probably have Jacob on at some point here too. And we should talk about this in a little bit of detail because he actually tried running the corner grocery store. And it's fascinating to talk to him about some of the struggles with it. Let me just give you one very specific one. If you look at the grocery business, the margins are generally really small. Really, really small. You know, I go in and buy that Mountain Dew Kickstart that I like. You know, you're not making that much money off of that. And so what happens is you wind up in essentially a volume kind of business. Because the margins are so small, you've got to do a high amount of volume. You've got to sell a lot of stuff. You also have to have a massive supply chain that can squeeze efficiencies. And I'm doing this in like a pro market, you know, pro centralization kind of way here. I'll explain it in the most positive, that kind of way. If we can wring efficiencies out of our supply chain, we can pass that savings on to the consumer. So if we can go and say, you toilet paper manufacturer and wherever, we're going to pay, you know, 2.3 cents a roll. Not 2.4 cents, but 2.3 cents a roll. And that's what we're going to pay. And we will buy from you, you know, 200 million rolls. Otherwise, you don't get our order. We'll go someplace else. Well, all of a sudden now, you can get stuff for very low cost. You can create this kind of international supply chain and drive down prices and bring cheap prices and cheap stuff to places that otherwise wouldn't get it. And that's actually the pro dollar store argument. A lot of people say, well, I'm in this neighborhood and I don't have anything. The dollar store is better than nothing. Let me give you the opposite of this. And I think we should go to the Dunkin' Donut example that I've written about, because here you get some actual like numbers that I know, but it's the same phenomena. There is no cheaper business to start than a donut shop. I mean, there literally isn't. You know, what do you need? You need a deep fryer, a cash register, and a display counter. That's it. You see a lot of immigrants to this country that are very poor starting donut shops because they can do it with relatively little capital. So when we look at a donut shop, you can get one of those going for, you know, a real low price. If you can find a place to do it, you can get it set up and running. Here's the problem. With Dunkin' Donuts around, Dunkin' Donuts comes into town and opens up and basically just captures the entire market. They can open up, you know, a block from you. They can open up 10 blocks from you. They can open up another side of town. We pave the way for them, literally, by putting in, you know, the wide streets and the turning lanes, and our zoning codes make it easy for them to come in. Our entire kind of land use system is set up to, you know, promote the person who can drive through and get the chain donut as opposed to the local place. So if you are the local entrepreneur, why are you going to mortgage your entire existence? Why are you going to, you know, borrow a bunch of money, spend all your time and energy doing this store, getting it all going, start taking all this risk, the risk that we celebrate as Americans, you know, the entrepreneurial risk? Why are you going to do this when a Dunkin' Donuts can come in with like the love of the community's zoning codes, all the financing, all the way up to Wall Street? Why are you going to come in and make this huge risk when the chance of your competitor coming and wiping you out is huge? You're not going to. And so, you know, none of these places can even get a toehold. Now, the key about Dunkin' Donuts, as you know, in order to start a Dunkin' Donuts, what do you need to have? You have a lot of money.
Hundreds of dollars. Yeah, exactly. $1 million, exactly. Often.
The franchise requirement is that you have a net worth of $500,000. That's to qualify for a franchise. So when you walk in the door, they're like, show us that you have $500,000 net worth, or we're not even going to talk to you. So at that point, you're no longer an entrepreneur. You are an investor. Right? You're not taking a risk in a sense. You're not putting your blood, sweat, and tears into something. You're just an investor. And what we have done in the name of efficiency, and you can see it most in these kind of fragile neighborhoods, is we've shifted our economy from one of entrepreneurship and risk-taking to one of efficiency and investing. And this is the outcome you get.
It's wild, and it's very true for the dollar store model too. One of the things that I found fascinating about this report is it talks about how much consolidation there is in the dollar store industry, that like Dollar Tree and Dollar General are the same thing now. The two, there's really only a tiny handful of big players that are functioning in a big box kind of style, but proliferated across a bunch of small boxes throughout the country. They're offsetting the discounts and losses on one store with the discounts and losses on another store, in the same way that Walmart will put a loss leader at the front of, you know, the, you know, clothing section in order to offset a loss in the hardware section. So it's really wild how many ways, you know, centralization has to make our neighborhoods weaker. They just have more tools at their disposal when it comes down to it. The other insight that I found fascinating, and this is, you know, just speaking personally, the one that kind of hit me in the gut, was the insight about packaging that I thought was so interesting. It talked about how dollar stores, their biggest innovation really is that, you know, yes, like you talked about, they will get the toilet paper manufacturer to sell them the roll at a cent cheaper because they have more buying power. But also they will package that toilet paper in smaller quantities and then charge more per unit. Right. So for me, I live two blocks from a dollar store and I live two blocks from a discount grocery. It's a save a lot. I tend to buy my toilet paper, literally toilet paper, at the dollar store because I live in a small apartment and I want to buy a six pack. I don't want to buy a 12 pack. It's really that simple and stupid. My neighbors, because I live in sort of a marginal area and my neighbors to the north of me are a lot poorer than I am, they're probably buying the four or the two pack because that's what they can afford and they don't get the bulk discount. So very slowly, I would be shocked if this dollar store didn't price out the grocery store, which isn't great, doesn't sell a lot of the food that I like to eat. But, you know, you can buy a banana there. You can buy some grapes there. You can buy, you know, more than just non-perishables and ice cream. So it's challenging to think about, like, how you fell this kind of behemoth that is in a smaller package and seems like it would be friendlier, but is, as at least ILSR argues, working to extinguish the kind of community businesses that our neighborhoods actually need for their inefficiency.
This is the part that I find really interesting. And I'm excited to talk to Stacy about this because I don't think we necessarily disagree, but we certainly have different areas of emphasis. The report that they put together talked about basically using regulation to ban these things. And I there's a part of me that gets that, but it's also like just on its own, it's just attacking a symptom in a way that I don't think is really helpful. I've been in neighborhoods and South Memphis, I'll give you as an example, where it's a viable business strategy. If you own a car, to get up in the morning, drive to the Walmart, fill up your trunk with essentials, you know, toilet paper, toothpaste, deodorant, what have you, drive back and sell that out the back of your car because there's no other place to buy those things in the neighborhood. And yeah, there you're paying a huge premium per roll, you know, all that stuff. That's a viable business. Is that neighborhood better off with a dollar store or not? That's like a really difficult call, right? Should we ban them and not allow them in there because they're predatory? Right. It's a little bit like the, you know, the payday loan kind of thing. You talk to people who use payday loans and they're like, this saved me. I really needed it. But then you got other instances where like, wow, you're paying these massive interest rates and it's really predatory. The answer to both of these situations is that we actually need to start growing wealth in these neighborhoods. We actually need to start that incremental process of making these neighborhoods a little bit better, a little bit more prosperous, a little bit wealthier. She mentioned in the article that you, one of the articles that you sent me, the whole Tulsa, you know, neighborhood and how, you know, back before the automobile and before the highways and before all this, like, we're going to make this model really hyper-efficient push. These neighborhoods were dominantly African American, and they were thriving with entrepreneurs, with, you know, people basically meeting the needs of their neighbors at a local scale. We're not going to get back to that next year. We're not going to get back to that in 2019, but we can start to take those incremental steps to make that kind of an alternative a viable alternative again.
Absolutely. And you know, I agree with you, Chuck, that the one problem I had with this article was that it talks about community bottom-up resistance to the dollar store model, which I think is great. You know, absolutely exercise your purchasing power if you are able to do that. Again, not everyone is able to. Protest, if that is a method available to you, sure. But the policy solution, I was like, what does that do on to fix the core problem, which is like you need to eat, you know, and if you live in a place where you can't afford the grocery store, but you can't afford a single packed Twinkie, like what are you going to choose? Especially if the dollar store goes away. How do you, on the flip side of it, create the growth that you need? And one of the things I thought about a lot as I was reading the article was, I don't know if I've told you about this, Chuck, but my favorite grocery store in St. Louis is a nonprofit. It's called City Greens. And what they do, they receive grant funding to sell high quality local fresh food at cost to the local community. And it is about the size of a dollar store in terms of its physical footprint. It is run largely by volunteers. It's not a scalable model for sure, but it's not designed to be. It works for the people that are there. It's been open for 4 or 5 years, and I shop there a lot, and I, you know, pay some small dues because I'm someone who can afford to pay dues in order to subsidize the groceries of others. What other sort of businesses would you want to see, for instance, banks more friendly to loan to so that they can open up their own shop and possibly own their own business? How else can we grow the sort of incremental economy that would keep people fed and do it better than just simply shutting the grocery stores, the dollar stores down?
Right. I don't think there's an easy answer to this. Like, I don't think there's like one or two policy things. And maybe that was my problem with one of those articles, is that it seemed like, you know, do this and this and the problem's solved. You know, I don't think, for example, your nonprofit grocery is a viable example. It was a viable model, you know, long term.
Oh, without a doubt.
Right.
Yeah.
So great transitionary strategy, but not really a viable long-term model. So how do we get to that viable long-term model? And I'm going to give an answer that's dissatisfactory, I know. But the reality is, we need to, in a sense, trade the growth and efficiency that we have come to expect in our economy for local resiliency and local stability. We need a for-profit local corner grocer who is making their living by serving the needs of the people in their neighborhood. And that's not a viable business model today. So how do we make that be a viable business model? And the reality is, we need to, in a sense, take away the subsidies and the, you know, basically the preferences that we have created for these hyper efficient kind of what I would say like the dinosaurs, the woolly mammoths of business that we are propping up.
Yeah.
Allow them to go, I think, the way that most large things tend to go, which is to die off and go away and be replaced by smaller, more nimble, more tactile competitors at the local level. That's what needs to ultimately happen. How we get from here to there, I think we do it incrementally. I think we got to get started today. And if you're looking like, where do we get started? Just make it easier to walk in your neighborhood. It's like the catalyst for everything, right?
Yeah, right. Yes. Everything else. It's so true. Well, and that's a really good point, that too often when we think, how do we solve a problem like a proliferation of dollar stores, we think, okay, let's like put our brain in the store column and let's figure out like how to create other kinds of stores. But you're right. You have to think holistically about, you know, what sort of like parking situation is required to shop at other stores, you know, like how do we change our transportation system? And thinking about the whole health of the city one incremental step at a time is a way to solve a heck of a lot of problems. It's pretty amazing. Even if it's a little bit shakier ground, it can feel like if you want
as we sit here and talk today, the Apple earnings came in under expected and the stock market's going way down. And for those of you who don't track the market, it's been wobbling back and forth pretty violently the last 2.5 months, and a pretty steady downward trajectory. You know, in 2008, this economy tried to commit suicide. I mean, it tried to end itself, and it tried to end itself because it was not viable. It's like, I'm done. I'm trying to fail. This didn't work. And we said, no. You're not allowed to fail. Prop you back up. And so we propped up the dollar stores. We propped up the big box stores. We propped up all the real estate. We did this. I see this system trying to fail again. I see the system, you know, desperately seeking, you know, some kind of equilibrium, which is not where we're at right now. And, you know, that's scary and it's big and it's painful and it's abstract and it's distant from us. So I say, if you want to get started on this, go meet your neighbors. Go figure out how to make your neighborhood more walkable. Start doing incremental things. That there will be momentum around those, and we need those because I think this larger system is very, very fragile.
Agreed. So let's brighten things up a bit. I want to talk about what you've been reading over the break and watching and enjoying. And now that we've had a little bit of downtime, I feel really recharged. Let's go to the down zone. Tell me what has been on your kind of pop culture hit list this past month, Chuck.
You know, my kids now like movies. And so, like, we went to Mary Poppins, which is fantastic. It's a lot of fun. I mean, it will never. Yeah. Oh, really? Yeah. See, it will never. I mean, you saw the first one and it was just magical, and you sang the songs for years. And we would take like cross country road trips with my kids, and we'd all, you know, listen to Mary Poppins the whole time. This one will not be that for you, but the acting is great and the story's fun. And there's a couple moments where it's just like nostalgia washes over you, and it feels really good.
Yeah.
But you'll appreciate this. You know what they wanted to do over break? And we actually did this. We watched Harry Potter movies.
Oh, like, yay.
We would finish the day and we'd kind of gather on the couch and all snuggle up. And it gets kind of chilly here at night sometimes, and especially in our back room, and get under the blankets. And Gryffindor the dog would be there. And we would we watched 4, 5, 6 and then both 7 movies together as a family. And actually, that was a really fun way to spend evenings over Christmas break.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. Not least the dog part. We decided that 2019 is going to be the year we get a dog. So watch out for puppies. And but maybe not soon. We'll see. But if my partner has his way, it'll be very soon. I would like to do something a little bit different for the Down Zone. I traveled a little bit for the holiday. I went and visited Chris's family in Baltimore, Maryland. And we went to a lot of museums. And one of my favorites that I went to was something called the American Visionary Art Museum, which is a museum devoted to self-taught artists, like outsider artists is another word for it. Basically, anyone who made visual art without the benefit of art education. And this includes everything from like anonymous mental patients working in an art therapy class to, you know, a small business owner who in his spare time carved weird things out of wood. And it, you know, everything in between. And the backstory of the artist is equally as big a part of the work in the museum as the work itself. And it just made me think a little bit about strong towns in a weird way, like what we can do when we are working outside of structures that, you know, I mean, I'm a big believer in visual arts education. Chris went to art school and graduated from it in New York. But it unlocks some really fascinating things and a lot of soul. And a lot of the pieces in this museum functioned as public art in their past lives before they went to be in a permanent collection where people like me can ogle them. So I had a blast there. American Visionary Art Museum.
That's awesome. Isn't Baltimore just a great place?
I love it. I love it so much. I also got to ride their really crazy pop-up bike lane that they did. That's so getting all kinds of press for, I think, very good reason. It's baller protected with paint on the ground. It's really inexpensive. And I saw a ton of people riding it. It was really, really fun. So that was my one bit of urbanism tourism this time around.
Awesome. Thanks, Kia.
Good stuff. Thank you so much, Chuck, and thank you all for listening. I hope you had a really relaxing holiday vacation and get geared up for some exciting things to come with Strong Towns this year. I hope to be able to announce some of them shortly, but we got some big things percolating for you. So take care.
We definitely do.
Yeah. Some of which will get talked about in line for Space Mountain, I'm sure, next week. So take care and keep doing what you can to build a strong town.